Asgard. Corwin arrived at the Great Hall of Asgard to find that Anne wasn't there yet. Neither was Nanna, he determined after a quick glance around the hall, and Baldur waved to him with a cheerful smile and came over to greet him. Nanna said they would be a bit late. She wanted to show Anne the library, and they lost track of time, said the Shining One. Corwin laughed. Anne in a library losing track of time. No, that never happens. Your lady may never get her out of there, you know. Baldur smiled and nodded over Corwin's shoulder. It would seem she's managed it. Anne was pausing at the door, flanked by the goddess of the moon, and obviously feeling more than a little embarrassed to be seen in public. She stayed there for a moment as some of the noise died down and everybody looked over at the door. Corwin grinned at her in aesthetic appreciation. Her dark brown hair was braided back from her face in a pair of French braids, embellished with gold combs patterned with ferns and clasped together with a gold band just at the nape of her neck. The gold-encased leaf of Yggdrasil hung on its chain around her neck. Her dress was of a dark forest green fabric, patterned with woven leaves. Its skirts were very full, cut to just above her ankles, and the long sleeves came to a gentle point across the backs of her hands. Her only ring was the duelist's signet, and her earrings were simple gold studs. She had a simple gold belt of linked leaves around her waist. Over the dress, she had a sort of sleeveless vest coat, gathered up in two golden bands at the shoulder and made of a gray fabric that looked rather like opaque mist confined to a woven shape. Across her back, held by a band of tooled leather, she wore Kuranaikaze and Tonerikoken next to each other. Compared to some of the other worthies in the hall, she looked very unadorned, but Corwin knew very well that aside from one trip to the New Avalon Symphony with Kate, she hadn't ever dressed up since he'd known her. And given the blush rising in her cheeks and her clenched jaw as she struggled not to stare at the floor, she was obviously feeling horrendously uncomfortable. He started to go up to her, to try to offer some sort of moral support, but another figure in black and silver dress armor beat him to it. "Wow, look at you! All grown up and slaying dragons and getting feasts in your honor," said Gunnar Brynjelfr, as she stepped up to her lover, looked her up and down, and then grabbed her in a bear hug. "Guess they finally decided to let you out in public, right?" Anne was too busy burying her face in the mountain elf's hair and holding her for a moment to answer. When she finally pulled back, the two women stared into each other's eyes for a long, long moment. And then Gunnar smiled, a bit sadly, and Anne a bit wistfully. After a moment, Anne forced a smile onto her face and said, "You have no idea how much I was kicking myself about not having your gun with me when I took on that worm. It kept being out of reach." Gunnar laughed and hauled her over to the table. "Food first, then war stories. That's how it works." "Indeed," boomed a big, red-haired man who was already seated and looked somewhat impatient for the food part to begin. "You'll have to tell the story of how you defeated that worm, you know." "What?" Anne gasped, and then turned to stare at whoever was convenient, it happened to be Corwin, with a betrayed expression. Corwin had to suppress a laugh. "This is Asgard, Junie," he said, moving over to help Gunnar get the reluctant girl to the table. "Boasting of our great deeds is part of our culture. Sit down, eat, so we can all eat. You'll feel better on a full stomach." "It helps if you chug back a couple of quarts of mead," the red-haired man added helpfully. Anne sat down, eyeing the red-haired man dubiously. At his belt hung a short-handled hammer, and between that and his enormous frame, she was pretty sure he had to be Thor. "I think I'll start with a cup," she told him, looking a bit less like she was going to bolt. "I don't have quite your mass." Thora seemed to think this was very funny, but he obligingly poured her a small cup of mead. About an hour later, between Thor and Gunnar, Anne had consumed 2 small cups of mead, a copious amount of food, and had determinedly switched to juice in spite of Thor's amused attempts to get her smashed. "Okay," she said, resting her chin on her hand and contemplating with some dubiousness the idea of standing up in front of any number of gods and demigods to boast of what she'd been doing. "So how does this work? This thing that I've been tricked into doing?" Gunnar grinned. "Hey, take it as a compliment. They didn't even try to get Corwin to get up and boast after his ascension trial. It's the first time that's ever happened. They must think you're more worth the effort than he is." "May I remind you that I was performing a wedding?" Corwin objected. "I didn't really have time for boasting." "Anyway," Gunnar said, winking at Anne and ignoring Corwin, "what you do is, you get up and tell the story of how you went and trashed that spawn, and you make it as exciting as you possibly can. It's supposed to be entertainment and factual, usually in that order."
"So, the way Liza Shustal tells stories, then?" Anne asked.
"Yeah, about like that," Corwin agreed.
"In front of all of everybody here?" Anne quailed slightly. "Sensei's the one who gets up on stage. I'm just the sound technician."
Gunnar leaned over and nudged Thor in the ribs. "Thor, do us a favor, would you? Tell the story of the time you and Loki dressed up as Freya and went down to Jotunheim to get your hammer back, just so Anne can see how it's done." Thor, astonishingly, looked slightly abashed.
"Does it have to be that one?"
Anne heard Corwin snort as she watched the God of Thunder become embarrassed. "Bragi could tell the one about the Ragnarok and..."
"No, no, the point is not to hear somebody who's practiced at these go at it," Gunnar said, snickering.
"After all, Anne's never had any practice at all."
"Give me a couple of years and I'll be telling bedtime stories," Anne muttered under her breath, "but that doesn't help me now."
Corwin nearly snorted his ale. "Oh," Thor said, looking over at Anne. And then he took a deep swig of his ale, got to his feet, and launched into a story of how he and his companions had once been tricked by the king of the Utgard giants when he went out into the world. He described all the ways he had been tricked with great relish, the way he had failed to kill the giant he'd been traveling with, for instance. He seemed to take the most pleasure in the fact that though he'd been tricked, Loki, who had been his companion at the time, had been tricked too, never suspecting that the giant he was trying to out-eat at one point had been the incarnation of fire itself. Thor finished the story off by boasting that though he'd never been able to quaff the entirety of the dram that the giant had set before him, never had the sea level dropped when a giant picked up that goblet. When he sat down, there was a smattering of applause and a thumping of various goblets against the table in approval. And then various eyes started turning toward Anne. Anne bit her lip, then looked over at Gunnar.
"Kiss me for luck?"
she asked hopefully, and the Valkyrie grinned and planted one on her. And she got up, pushed a wisp of hair out of her face, and launched into a description of her excessively strange day. She glossed over her fight with Sionji as a warm-up, easy because she'd fought him before. Since she wasn't sure if Akio Otori had spies in Asgard, she didn't want her senpai to get killed by saying he'd let her win. Then she hit her stride with the fight against Toga. By the time she sat down, she was feeling more than a bit elated and slightly high. A number of wisps had worked their way out of her braids and were curling in elf locks around her face, and she was pretty sure that whatever Gunnar had put in her goblet when she paused for a drink had been something alcoholic, because she felt distinctly tipsy and still rather thirsty. The applause was much louder for her, she guessed because they hadn't heard this story before, and there was a great deal of banging of cups. Then Thor gave her another cup of mead to drink and a big kiss on the cheek.
"Skål," he said,
raising a mug to her. Gunnar followed suit. Skål! Anne paused, and then grinned back at him a bit recklessly. Ah, the hell with it, she thought. Somebody once said that you should try everything once, and I've never been drunk in a hall full of gods before. She raised her own in response, and drank it down in a single gulp. Some hours later, she found herself sitting on Corwin's front doorstep next to Gunnar. Corwin was already inside, and presumably asleep, like the sane god he was. He'd given her a key when she and Gunnar had wandered off to count stars from the rooftop of the Valkyrie's Hall. "Thank you, Gunnar," Anne said. Then she giggled. "I had a really good time, even if my hangover won't think so in the morning." Gunnar grinned. "It won't last too long. Part of the magic of Asgard." Anne leaned against her erstwhile lover and sighed. "This is the part where we're supposed to go to bed, isn't it?" she said softly. "Yes," Gunnar said, and turned and gave her a gentle kiss. "This is the part where we go to bed." "I can't promise anything's going to be different, Gunnar," Anne said, sounding a little distant and somewhat blurred. "Or the same. I still love you. It's just... it's not the same." "Of course it isn't. You're out there doing things, and I'm here doing things, and people change," Gunnar said, and wrapped an arm around Anne's waist. "Nobody ever said anything had to be forever. We just try to do the best we can and grab the chances when they come." Anne let her head rest against Gunnar's shoulder. She made a happy, contented sound, and then she unexpectedly fell asleep right where she was. It took Gunnar several minutes to realize what had happened. Given how much mead she and Thor had poured into the girl, she wasn't surprised her thought processes weren't quite up to speed. Then she grinned. "I guess," she said to her sleeping friend, "that this is the part where I put you to bed and go alone back to mine as payback for getting you sloshed when you didn't intend to be. Oh well, serves me right." She shifted her weight around until she could pick up the sleeping girl, swords and all, and carried her off to bed. Orifus. "Begin!" Anubishu snarled, and waited, tense, while Shuten stared at him across the taut length of chain in his hands. The tableau held for a few moments before the big man added, "Or did the Yoroi choose the wrong boy?" That was enough of a goad to send Shuten surging across the mat, the weighted end of chain whirling in his hands as he launched himself at the older man. "I..." The resounding smack of the flat of Anubishu's huge nodachi slamming into his side cut off whatever Shuten had been about to say, and sent him skidding back across the room on his ass. He struggled to his feet, gasping, with his hand pressed against his side, and glared at the other warlord.
"Don't say... it,"
he snarled between gasping breaths. "Sionji was right," Anubishu muttered. "You should be better. I am ashamed."
"I am better,"
the red-headed boy protested.
"You are not good enough."
There was a pause as light blue eyes bored into dark blue. Then Shuten looked away.
"Yamao was my teacher, boy," Anubishu growled.
Shuten opened his mouth, then closed it at his master's furious gaze.
"I will not have you dishonor his armor. You have raw talent. It is not enough. You will come at me again, and you will keep coming at me for the rest of the night until you cannot stand or you score a touch. And if it is not the latter, we will resume tomorrow, immediately after breakfast."
Shuten swallowed.
And when you can come at me and score a touch 3 times, Anubishu went on, you will thrash that pretty boy of Sionji's until he cannot stand. But I will deal with Sionji myself. We will have our honor avenged. After a moment, Shuten straightened and took his hand away from his side, and his eyes burned with an inner fire all their own. Asgard, Friday, February 19th, 2410. Corwin and Anne were eating breakfast and trying to figure out which of Asgard's sights to hit that day when there came a knock at the door. Anne glanced at Corwin, who swallowed his Rice Krispies and shrugged. I'm not expecting anyone, he said. Maybe it's Gunnar, Anne speculated. At this hour? Anne laughed. True. Corwin got up, went to the door, and opened it to reveal the most ornately dressed person Anne had ever seen. He was a tall, slim fellow with blonde hair and markedly pointed ears. Some type of elf, Anne supposed, and he was dressed in an elaborate uniform with a lot of gold braid. The coat of his uniform was double-breasted, with 2 columns of gilded buttons, each horizontal pair linked together with a length of golden chain. He had a floppy cap edged with the same braid. His hair was done up in elaborate plaits, festooned with colorful feathers, and his tall, brass-buckled boots had spurs. This figure, eye-catching even in Asgard, bowed low, appearing not at all put out that the man he was bowing to was unshaven and dressed in rumpled sweatpants and a faded, slightly holy Art of Noise Live in Toronto t-shirt. Then he said something in a song-like language Anne couldn't even slightly understand. Certainly it wasn't Alvish. Handed over a gilt-edged envelope, pivoted on his heel, and left. Corwin watched him go down the hall, then shut the door and returned to the table, looking bemused. Anne wanted to ask him what that had been about, but she sat quietly, exercising her samurai self-control and feeling vaguely smug about it, while Corwin opened the envelope and read the card inside. Hum, Corwin said, tossing the card onto the middle of the table. Anne looked at it, but got nothing more from that than she had from the oddly dressed elf's markings. It was covered in angular squiggles that she assumed were writing, but which meant nothing to her. What language is that? She asked, tilting her head. Looks a bit like Klingon. Corwin smiled wryly. Old High Draconic, barely legible. It's an invitation. Well, really it's a summons, but it's phrased like an invitation. He picked up the card again, then read from it in a pompous voice. His August and Terrible Majesty, Bahamut the Seventh, King of the Dragons of Alfheim, requests the pleasure of your company. He tossed the card on the table again and grinned at Anne. Want to meet the King of the Dragons? Valhalla wasn't what Anne had expected. It was a big, imposing building from outside, which was true to her expectations, but inside it was strange. After a vestibule guarded by a uniformed porter, there seemed to be an infinitely long corridor, stretching away beyond the vanishing point. The corridor was lined with doors, and occasionally smaller hallways would branch off to the sides. As Corwin led her past one of them, Anne glanced down it and saw that it, too, appeared to be infinite. That was a little mind-bending, so she chose to concentrate instead on following Corwin, who seemed to know where he was going. They negotiated several corners, went through a few doors, into still more endless marble hallways, and generally worked their way deeper and deeper into the labyrinth. In the distance, Anne could hear the faint sounds of swordplay, gunfire, shouting, and something that sounded a bit like a jazz combo. The sharp tang of petroleum hit Anne's nostrils as she followed Corwin through another door. This one had looked like all the others from the outside,
but once they were through it, they were in a place that looked entirely different from the cool marble corridors of Valhalla. This was a big, wide-open, concrete-floored room with metal walls, utilitarian and clean, with huge, bright lights hanging from the high steel ceiling. It reminded her quite a bit of Corwin's underground domain in New Avalon. This room wasn't as large as most of Corwin's subterranean chambers, but it had a similar sort of ambiance, and the contents also put her in mind of his lair. It was full of small aerospace craft, arranged in neat rows and surrounded by various technical-looking bits of machinery. Maintenance equipment, most likely. Anne, not being really into military hardware, didn't recognize most of them, but she knew a fighter from a commercial craft, and these were all fighters of one type or another. The room hummed with activity. Jumpsuited technicians of a dozen races moved here and there, carrying parts and tools, inspecting things, connecting hoses from the various machines to different craft. As Corwin and Anne entered the room, a slim woman with pale blonde hair detached herself from a group of techs and crossed to them with a welcoming look. Corwin bent down and gave her a kiss as she approached. "Lenneth," he said, smiling. "My lord," she replied with an impish smile. "Anne Cross, Lenneth Winternight," Corwin said, gesturing. "Lenneth is the Valkyrie mechanic." "Good day to you, Lady Anne," Lenneth said with a bow. "I've heard so much about you." Anne laughed. After the feast, she'd lost a good bit of the intimidation she'd felt about Asgard and its peoples, and said she hoped it was nothing too bad. "Not at all," Lenneth replied, grinning. Then, turning the grin to Corwin, she went on, "I bet I know what you're here for." "Is my lightning ready?" Corwin asked as he started following her down one of the rows of small craft. "You're going to Draconia, aren't you?" Lenneth asked. "I thought this would come, so I prepped her specially for you last night. Not that she wasn't ready anyway, of course, but she could always do with a touch-up. You know how these old British jets are." They stopped at one of the revetments near the far end of the hangar, where three technicians were just completing the fueling of a sleek aircraft. It looked old to Anne's eyes, how old she couldn't guess, and was obviously an atmospheric craft. It swept back wings, aerodynamic lines, and the massive air intake surrounding its nose cone spoke clearly to that. At the tail, the twin exhausts of its jet engines were arranged in an unusual shape like an over-under shotgun. It was painted a deep, glossy black with silver trim. Its vertical tail fin was emblazoned with the skull and lightning sigil of the Valkyrie, and on the sides of the nose was the red and white roundel of the Asgardian Defense Forces. "Beautiful," Corwin said. "Absolutely beautiful." He turned to Anne with a grin. "Let's go flying, shall we?" As they hurtled toward Alfheim at nearly the speed of sound, Anne mused on the interesting contradiction that was Corwin's fondness for antique machinery. Here was a man whose province, quite literally, encompassed the cutting edge of vehicle technology, whose mother was the embodiment of the future itself, and yet so many of his things were old. His Griffin limousine, the HB-88 jet car, the one-hit wonder, and, well, this, an English Electric Lightning T-5 jet fighter, circa 1965. So much of Corwin's favorite technology felt like this, too. The Lightning was a bit cramped, like all fighter craft tended to be, but it had a sort of welcoming solidity to it. The technology it contained was old, but not creaky. Inside, it was quite like the HB-88, if a bit more organized, and since that was the first example of Corwin's taste in old gear that Anne had ever encountered, it had become something of a benchmark to her. And, like the HB-88, it could go like hell. Corwin was deliberately keeping below the overcast, and with today's weather that was very low indeed, so that she could see things on the ground rushing past. This was deserted country, mountains too steep to farm and too barren for towns, so they weren't disturbing anyone but some goats by blasting through the valleys at 700 miles an hour. In the little rear-view mirror on her side of the instrument panel, Anne could see nothing but a huge cloud of snow kicked up by their passage. "Probably going to be some crappy weather at the border," Corwin's voice mused tinnily in the earphones built into her flight helmet. "There usually is. Let's see if we can get above this mess." "Okay," Anne agreed, or at least started to. Before she could get both syllables out, Corwin had twitched back on the control stick a bit and firewalled the throttles. The Lightning stood on its tail and headed for the sky at the top of what Anne's imagination fancifully depicted as a solid, visible column of noise. They popped out of the cloud layer at 25,000 feet into the most brilliant blue sky Anne had ever seen, a markedly darker blue than it was when it could be seen from the ground, and sunlight flooded the cockpit, prompting both of them to snap down their helmets' tinted visors. Corwin leveled the jet off and kept the throttles wide open. The ride got eerily quiet. Corwin glanced sideways at Anne. Because of the tinted visor, she couldn't see his eyes, but the grin on the lower half of his face said enough. She laughed. "You and your toys," she said fondly. Corwin snapped the Lightning through a roll, drawing a delighted shriek from his passenger, then checked his heading and aimed the missile they were riding at Alfheim again. An hour later, they were on the ground. The Lightning looked a bit incongruous, parked on the apron at Draconia International between the sleek Asgardian Air Service Longship-class airliners, with their dragon's head paint jobs, Anne thought, but she didn't give it too much consideration before her attention was grabbed by other matters. They changed their clothes in the airport's restrooms, trading their flight suits for clothes more suitable to a royal audience. Those clothes had somehow managed to remain presentable despite having been stuffed into the Lightning's minuscule baggage compartment in an equally minuscule bag, a feat that had more to do with the bag than the clothes. When they regrouped on the concourse, they were a much more impressive pair, she decked out in her Ash Knight's finery, he in a razor-creased Valkyrie dress uniform. The architecture of Draconia was much like that of the rest of the Celestial Realm, as far as Anne's limited experience could tell her, but there were some interesting differences. The buildings were a little bigger and a little further apart than they were in Asgard, for example, and most of the shops were on the top rather than the bottom floors. The streets were cobbled and not very wide, without much vehicle traffic. They didn't have much foot traffic either, really, since most of the city's population preferred to fly. Corwin had to guide Anne along, since so much of her attention was focused on the aerial traffic above them. He had expected that. He stole his own glances whenever he could get them, for that matter, because the skies over Draconia were always a fascinating sight. There were two layers to the traffic pattern above the city. At rooftop level, most of the winged shapes passing from one building to another or cruising along the streets were humanoid but for their wings. Higher up, they were mostly dragons in their full glory. The sunlight, for it was not overcast here, glinting from scales of all the colors in the rainbow. "Are all these people dragons?" Anne asked. Corwin grinned. "Most of them," he said. "Pretty much all the flying ones. There are other races living in Draconia, like anywhere else. Mountain elves and dwarves, mostly. But you can see that the city is geared toward flyers." "Why are so many of them in human form?" "Efficiency," Corwin said. "The shops and common buildings would have to be huge to accommodate full-size dragons. That's why dragons never built cities until after they started trading with the other peoples of the upper worlds. Draconia started out as the crossroads of two trade routes, one from Western Alfheim and one from Vanaheim. The elven, dwarven, and human traders started building shops and taverns in which to meet, and the dragons found it more convenient to go among them in their smaller shapes. Eventually, they started building their own shops and whatnot. "Where do they live?" Anne wondered. Corwin gestured to the row of high, jagged mountains looming on the horizon beyond the city to the north. "In caves, like they always have," he said. They were walking up a street that ran directly toward those mountains, sloping up at a significant angle. Anne could feel her calf muscles starting to ache from the climb, until the edge of the city, which lapped at the bases of those mountains like surf on a beach. At the top of the street, towering over all the other buildings of Draconia, was a tall white structure that was plainly a government building of some kind. "That's the Dragon King's Palace," Corwin confirmed. "That's where we're headed. It's built where it is because it basically covers the mouth of the king's ancient cave. He still lives there."
"How old is he?"
Corwin chuckled. "Put it this way. He's thought of as a well-established king by the dragons today. In his prime, you might say. When my grandfather was my age, and Asgard was a little town with a well, Bahamut the Seventh was considered a youthful and dynamic ruler." Anne looked impressed.
"And he's the Seventh?"
"The Seventh to take the name Bahamut. There have been at least 20 Dragon Kings. They're an incredibly old people, even by Asgard standards."
"What does he want to see you for?"
Corwin shrugged. "Not sure. I have a suspicion, but I'd rather not say anything until we see him." That did little to quell the rising nervousness within Anne. She frowned at herself and pushed it down. She'd almost gotten over being intimidated, but not awed. She hoped she never got over being awed by Asgard after a week there, and now this. She was beginning to wonder if she would ever feel entirely comfortable anywhere. The week had been a grand adventure indeed, but truth be told, she was starting to look forward to going home again. Home itself was still kind of an odd concept to her, but that was a battle scar to be contemplated at another time. They entered the great hall of the Dragon King's palace, which was opulent and beautiful, as Anne had expected. In addition to serving as the king's official residence, the palace was the center of Draconia's government, so there were a lot of elaborately costumed people around, some with wings, some without, going here and there on inscrutably official errands. As Corwin and Anne entered, a coppery-winged woman in a snappy blue uniform crossed to them with a smile.
"Lord Corwin," she said, "welcome back. And you must be Lady Anne. Welcome to Draconia. Will you come with me, please?"
Their course took them deep into the building, into corridors of progressively older appearance. As they delved, Corwin shook his head and chuckled quietly.
"What?"
Anne asked.
"He's not making it easy for you," Corwin replied, sounding amused.
Before Anne could ask what he meant by that, they came to the end of the darkest, oldest-looking corridor yet, really more a tunnel than a hall. It ended in a roughly circular wall of age-darkened timbers pierced by an iron-banded double door.
"Go right in," said the uniformed woman, and then she left them there and went briskly back the way they'd come, her boot heels clacking sharply on the stone floor.
Corwin made sure his uniform tunic was straight, took a quick look at Anne's finery, then said, "Here we go. Just be cool. Dragons like manners, but you don't have to be stiff. Ready?"
"No," Anne replied.
Corwin grinned as if he hadn't heard her. "Great," he said, then opened the door and waved her through. Half expecting to find herself in an opulent audience chamber, Anne stepped through the door. The room beyond wasn't a room at all. It was a cave.
cavern, really, in the biggest sense of the word. Anne couldn't see the back or sides of it, and the ceiling was only vaguely visible. She could sense its presence more than actually see it. The walls were smooth gray stone that looked almost as though it had been polished, but they weren't flat. Torches were affixed to it here and there, casting pools of yellow light. Most of the illumination came from chandeliers hanging on chains from the indistinctly distant ceiling. Most of the direct illumination, anyway. Below the torches and chandeliers, the room blazed with reflected light, light that bounced and shone and glittered from the biggest heap of treasure Anne had ever seen. It rolled from one side of the cavern to the other like sand dunes in a desert. Gold coins, silver coins, jeweled swords, cups, dinnerware, pieces of armor, engraved firearms, loose gems, trophies, statuary. Then she saw what rested atop all that treasure, and the treasure itself became somewhat insignificant. Bahamut the Seventh, King of the Dragons, had chosen not to assume his humanoid form for this audience. He lay upon his treasure hoard in his full glory, the biggest and mightiest of all the dragons of Alfheim, on full display. He was huge, at least 200 feet long, though it was hard to tell for sure because he was coiled up slightly, and that didn't include the enormous ribbed wings that were folded loosely at his sides. A single claw would have no problem picking up a full-grown horse, Anne guessed, or perhaps even more. His scales rippled like water over steel in the light of the cavern, but there was an iridescent sheen to them that made her wonder if she had the right metal. The spines that ran from the crest of his head all the way to the tip of his tail looked like they could cut solid pieces out of the wind. As they walked in, he raised his head and turned to look at them, and Anne was mentally staggered, if not physically. His eyes were a deep, shining blue, the color of the sky they had just come through, and the presence in them as he focused on the two humans was enough to impact Anne's psychic shielding and nearly knock her over. It wasn't an inimical presence, though, just incredibly strong, hard, and brilliant. It was like standing under the noonday sun in the middle of a desert, except there was no sensation of heat. Then he spoke, and his voice boomed around the room before deigning to be comprehensible to mere humans. "Well, young Lord Ravenhair, welcome again to my kingdom. What news have you of my nephew?" "He's well, Your Majesty," Corwin replied. The dragon grunted noncommittally. "Too busy courting his elf maid to visit his uncle, apparently." Corwin hesitated for a moment, looking for a delicate phrasing, then said, "He's had difficulties with her family." The Dragon King drew back his head to regard the young god with a half-quizzical, half-annoyed look. "Her family? Fah! What business is it of theirs? In his place I'd have burnt their freehold and eaten their cattle by now to teach them their place." Lowering his head again, Bahamut fixed Corwin with a faintly reproachful look and added, "You've made him soft, boy." Anne unsuccessfully suppressed a snort of laughter. Given his awe-inspiring presence, there was something ineffably funny about the King of the Dragons grumping at Corwin this way. The sound died away into a squeak as Bahamut turned his scrutiny to her. "And who might you be?" he asked. "No Ys, I should think. Certainly neither of young Ravenhair's women, though you hold yourself a bit like the brash one." "Ah, you bear a splinter of the World Tree and an Iron Bridge blade. You must be Baldur's golden girl. Well, speak up." Corwin made to intervene. "Your Majesty, may I in—" "No, you may not, boy," Bahamut interrupted him. "I asked her, didn't I?" Anne glanced at Corwin with a nervous grin, and swept her skirts out to either side of her and dropped a full and proper curtsy.
"Your Majesty, my name is Anne Cross, Knight of the Ash Tree and Journeywoman of the Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu," she said, then paused and added, "Ah, you do me great honor by letting me see you in your true form."
As she said the last part, Anne winced a little internally. It struck her as kind of a dumb thing to say, but then again, it wasn't as though she had expected the Dragon King to speak to her. If she had, she'd have prepared remarks. As it was, Bahamut's lip curled back slightly from his gleaming teeth in an expression that looked like a smile.
"Hmm. You flatter me," he said, sounding pleased. "There are much fairer beasts in my kingdom than I, but playing to an old dragon's vanity is never a bad move. You're welcome in Draconia, child. You did all creation a service by bloodying my cousin's nose."
He angled his head indicatively toward Corwin, then added, "Pray wait a few moments while I deal with this whelp, and I'll try to think of some suitable way of rewarding you." Leaving her pondering this notion, Bahamut turned to Corwin. When he spoke again, his voice had lost most of its mocking gruffness and become a touch more formal.
"Nearly a score of years ago, your grandfather and I sealed a pact of amity between our peoples, the first such agreement ever made. You were the symbol of that accord, an honor I know has not always rested easily on your shoulders," the Dragon King added with a wry little chuckle. "Now you are a man," Bahamut went on, "and you stand ready to welcome your own firstborn into the world. As I honored you, so I wish to honor her, as an affirmation of my people's alliance with yours, and of my own affection for you."
Corwin blinked. He'd had his suspicions about this summons, but they hadn't included the direction he now saw this taking. Behind the two humans, the door to Bahamut's cavern opened. Two winged and uniformed officers entered, carrying between them a smallish wooden chest banded in black iron and secured with an elaborate lock. They bore the chest to Corwin, then placed it on a small folding table one had carried in his free hand. The taller of the two produced an ornate iron key, plied the lock with it, and then swung the lid open to display the chest's contents. Dull orange light shone from within the box onto Corwin's face. Anne edged across to stand next to him for a look, then made a low sound of surprise. The light, along with a good bit of heat, came from a bed of banked and glowing coals that filled the chest, and nestled in that bed was an egg the size of a bowling ball. Its shell was a dull red color, like iron in a fire.
"You know I have no children of my own," Bahamut told Corwin. "This egg comes from my dear sister Matalde the Red, who makes her lair in the Tindalos. I desire the child within to be the boon companion of your soon-to-be-born daughter, just as young Nall has been yours."
Corwin looked from the Dragon King's face to the egg and back.
"Your Majesty, I don't know what to say," he admitted. "It will be as you command."
Bahamut smiled. The two uniformed men locked up the case again and departed, leaving it on its stand before Corwin. Anne noticed that the lid bore an ornate draconic inscription in what looked like gold.
"Send word to me when you return to Midgard," the Dragon King said, "and I will have the egg delivered to your home."
Corwin nodded.
"I will, and thank you, Your Majesty."
"Perhaps we shall establish a tradition, you and I," Bahamut said. "Your family line and mine may continue to walk together for generations to come."
Corwin smiled. generations come far apart in your family, he said. The Dragon King chuckled. True enough. Then he turned his attention back to Anne. As for you, young knight, I believe I have just the thing. So saying, he rummaged amid the coins at his feet for a moment, his movements impossibly delicate with such giant talons, before plucking out a single shining disc of metal and tossing it her way. She caught it, turned it over, and looked at it. It was a big coin, as coins went, covering nearly her entire palm, and it was thick and heavy for its size. It was cool to the touch and gleamed with the sheen of fine silver. The face Anne could see bore the bas-relief profile of an honest-looking, unpretentious elven woman, ringed around with elvish script. On the reverse, she found the image of a craggy mountain valley with a waterfall to one side, and more elvish writing. "It's an elven taller," Bahamut said when she looked from the coin back to his face. "So called because they were minted in the town of Bergalventhal, ancestral seat of our old friends the Mountain Elves, the oldest money in Alfheim." In a confidential tone, the old dragon added, "The dwarves don't like to admit it, but they got the idea for coinage from Queen Gunnhildr, whose face you see there." Settling back on his hoard a bit, he added casually, "I believe you may know her great-great-grandniece." Anne looked back at the coin, blinked, then turned her eyes back to the dragon and said in a slightly stunned voice, "I can see the resemblance. Thank you." The Dragon King smiled slightly. "You're welcome. Now, please take young Ravenhair somewhere, will you? I'm an old dragon, and I need my rest." Corwin grinned and bowed. "Good day, Your Majesty," he said, and the two of them left. As they walked back up the tunnel toward the outer palace, Corwin said offhandedly, "I do hope you're not too disappointed with your vacation, Junichan. I mean, Kate told me about all the reading you were planning to do, and you haven't gotten to any of it." Anne gaped at him for a second, then laughed and smacked him on the back of the head. "Nana gave me a copy of one of the books I found in the library, and I've been reading it when you weren't looking," she said. Then she tilted her head and said, "Speaking of reading, what did the inscription on that chest say?" Corwin laughed. "Caution, contents extremely hot," he said. Anne spent two more whirlwind days in Asgard, departing for Tomodachi with Corwin only at the last possible minute on Sunday night. Parting from Gunnar again was hard, but not as painful as the first time. With the alert in Asgard lifted, the elven Valkyrie had more freedom of movement than she had before, and though she did still have a job to do in Asgard, that meant at least that she could visit. And of course, Anne would be back to Asgard in her turn. She had no doubt whatsoever of that. Orifus. The only hint that someone had come into Akio Otori's office was the slight click of the latch as the door closed. From that pregnant, menacing silence, he knew exactly who had come in. "Lady Kyra," he said, turning his chair away from the window. Kyra stood at slender attention on the other side of his desk, her breathing slightly accelerated, her eyes narrowed. She had the usual reaction to him that most women did, and he knew how much she hated that in herself. There was always the chance that her vengeful fury would get the better of her and she would attack him. Another source of amusing uncertainty, as he knew perfectly well that she couldn't beat him. He also had four things that she wanted very badly, and the ability to give her a fifth,
if she did well and he succeeded. Moreover, he treated her with the appearance of respect, as no one in her life ever had before. And that alone, combined with his skill at handling women, would probably have been enough. However, "You sent for me, Akio-sama?" she said in her husky alto. "I did," he agreed. "I need you to go back to Midgard, Lady Kyra. There are messages I need delivered, there is information I need gathered, and there is no one else who I trust to go." Kyra considered his request. "What messages? What information?" "Based on what you told me about Lord Venger attempting to subvert some of my underlings, I have decided it's time to rid ourselves of his posturing. I wish you to take a message to the man who he once called Master." Kyra bristled. "Another Sith? They're all useless, Akio-sama. Their perverted reliance upon powers beyond themselves leaves them all weak and vulnerable to outside influence." "Ah, but it is my influence they're vulnerable to, Kyra." He smiled, then watched her try to contain her twin opposed desires to kill him and to melt at the sound of his voice. When she held herself to trembling attention, he continued, "However, I wish to make it clear to them that we are not looking to deal in trifles here. You will find one of this man's current apprentices at Sarji Station, in the company of a number of underlings. He's dispatched them there on some errand. Discover their mission, destroy the underlings, and incapacitate the Sith. Leave this message behind." He slid an envelope marked with the seal of the Black Rose Order across his desk. "And then complete the mission for them." She frowned. "You would have me do their work for them?" "I wish to point out our goodwill towards him." He favored her with an ironic smile and went on, "And also how sloppy are his minions. I don't care how you do this, Kyra. You may feel free to indulge your imagination in humiliating the Sith. I simply wish to make it clear to his master that he is dealing with someone worthy of respect." "And Venger?" "Roger Tremaine will not be a problem much longer." Akio smiled and laced his fingers together. "He has tangled with Sionji before and come away near dead. The next time he interferes with our resident psychotic's pet apprentice, I suspect he will relearn that lesson to his detriment." Kyra shook her head. "He'll betray you, Akio-sama. You should just let me cut his throat while he sleeps." "Not yet, my dear," he said quietly. "I still have use for him for a little while longer." He slid her another envelope, this one entirely black. "Everything you require that you do not already have is in here. Go and show these fools exactly who they are dealing with, if you would." She took up both envelopes, studied the outside of the black one, and then slid both inside her armor. "Yes, Akio-sama," she said, smiled viciously, and disappeared. Akio leaned back in his chair and smiled thoughtfully. She really was lovely, but there was no point in playing with her. And she was very, very effective. A pity the Kaneko had massacred her cousins 70 years ago. He could have made good use of them, though of course they would not have been as easy to manipulate as she was. He chuckled darkly to himself, then picked up the phone on his desk and said, "Nanami, I want to see your report on the woman you and Toga encountered in New Avalon again." Monday, February 22nd, 2410. Harkness Street High School, New Avalon, Zeta Cygni. Courtney Whitmore slumped back in her chair, listening to the February wind gently rattle the windows and waiting for the first bell of classes to announce the end of winter break and the return to the school year. Various students were filtering in to claim their chairs for the first period of AP history, some of them talking about their breaks, others wondering what the homework load was going to be like that evening. Catherine Thorington drifted in, looking freckly and cheerful and sun-warmed, followed by Miyaka Yuki and Yui Hongo, who both looked thoroughly sleep-deprived.
"What happened to you?"
Courtney asked them.
Yui shook her head.
"Stayed up too late focusing lights last night. It's tech week. We open Friday night."
"Oh, right."
Courtney grinned.
"Should I get tickets?"
"Do not," Yui groaned. "Ask me that question right now. Ask Miyaka."
"Of course you should get tickets," Miyaka said firmly.
"Where's Anne?"
"I don't know," Catherine said. "I thought she said she was staying home for winter break, but..."
As if summoned by her name, Anne hurried into the room just as the bell rang, flopped down in the chair next to Courtney, then yelped and shifted her position slightly. Riding on her right shoulder was a brand new sword, new enough that she apparently wasn't used to it being there. She looked both exhausted and pleased with herself. Her four friends' eyes flashed from the sword to her face.
"Wow,"
Courtney whispered as they waited for Professor Jewel to come into the classroom.
"When did you get that?"
Anne's grin nearly split her face.
"Monday," she said.
"If you want to come help me shelve a lot of books tonight, I'll even tell you how." Airy Productions Unlimited presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Order of the Rose, a Duelist Opera. First movement, Ash Night. The Order of the Rose will return.